established?
I think there were several. I worked my way up in those 4 years, because I stayed in the ROTC for 4 years in college. And, you know, I did my Saturday afternoon marching, and I went into some parades, and they sent us one summer to an Air Force base so we could actually see what an airplane looked like. And so I had done a good job there, and there were several of us. I wasn't the only one. But I think graduating with a certificate as a distinguished medical graduate then helped several years later when I wanted to get married and I applied for the medical school program. Anyway, the last story about Colgate, which I think we mentioned before, is I had worked my way through, I'd gotten scholarships, but I got my room and board by working in the kitchen at the fraternity house. Mm-hmm. And I did everything from making breakfast to making beds to washing dishes and that sort of stuff. What I didn't tell you was that the room and board that we got, the food was identical to what everybody else had, but the room was down in the basement of the fraternity house, and it used to be called the Mole Hole, M-O-L-E hole, and there were four or five of us who had little rooms down there with no windows. I mean, in today's world, you couldn't do such a thing because it would be a fire hazard. Sure. But they had put up some sort of plywood walls, and down in this mole hole where we had a bar and a little, they had a room which the fraternity brothers used to call their, you know, we used to call it our meeting room. Actually, it was a place to sit and drink beer. But that's where my room was, down in the mole hole. Anyway, I got to medical school. And I was reading the New York Times the other day about Paul Zoll, who pioneered the development of pacemakers at Harvard. And George Smith and others had, I guess, studied under him. But what is said in this obituary in the New York Times, which was January 8th, 1999, I'll give it to you, it said, in those days, quote, the standard treatment for cardiac arrest was crude. A doctor would cut into the chest and squeeze the heart with his hand to pump blood through the body. Our cardiologists carried large jackknives, and even our poor eye surgeons were taken to the door lab and shown how to cut into chests. Well, after that, eventually closed chest resuscitation was developed in the mid-50s, and then pacemakers, as we know. But the reason that caught my eye was I can remember very well that one of the cardiac surgeons, Dr. Ralph Alley was his name, who used to give us our lectures on, some of our lectures on cardiac anatomy and that. And he used to say, I can recall one time when he said, now you have to be very careful, you don't fall asleep in class, because someone may cut open your chest and start pumping on your heart, thinking you'd had a cardiac arrest. And I remember that story when I saw this people walking around, because I can recall as a sophomore, maybe as a junior, being on one of the wards when, in fact, someone had a cardiac arrest, and one of the overzealous interns pulled out a scalpel from his jacket or where he got it, I'm not sure, and cut open this person's chest and started manually massaging the heart and then calling for help because, you know, what are you going to do now? You got to have a surgeon come in, stick in a chest tube, close the chest, and all the rest. So that was discouraged, but what I'm saying to you is when I started medical school in 1954, there were still some places in the country where open cardiac massage was used to restart a heart with a sudden cardiac arrest. Of course, that is now would be considered malpractice. It's passé. Yes. And over the next couple of years, closed chest, where you learned how to push on the chest, developed, and then ultimately cardiac pacemakers. Anyway,
I wonder how many patients actually survived past the first couple of minutes.
I have no idea. You wonder if any of them really needed it, and that's a very good question. But yes, in fact, I saw that and witnessed that only once, and of course it was roundly discouraged. But I remember Dr. Alley telling us, first of all, don't go opening people's chests. That's something that heart surgeons should do, but not...
And don't fall asleep in class.
Yeah, don't fall asleep in class.
That's funny.
So then my first encounter with, I guess you'd call, labor movement. In the summer of 55, I was just finished my freshman year. I got a job, as I told you before, living in a hotel in downtown Albany, taking care of a paraplegic, a man who was in a wheelchair.
Mm-hmm.
I just used Mr. P, though I won't use his name.
Right.
And I worked for him for about 6 or 7 months as his caretaker, and I would get him up in the morning, then I'd go off to school. Well, that summer, I'd still do the same, except there was no summer school for medical students the summer between your first and second year. There was between second and third, but the only summer I remember getting off was the summer between my first and second year, and I got a job driving a truck for Pepsi-Cola, and I had a route that would take me up into the hills north of Albany, up toward Lake George, and I would deliver Pepsi-Cola. They needed extra drivers during the summer because all of these resort areas would open in the summer, and you had to deliver Pepsi-Cola to these little restaurants and bars and places that were closed the rest of the year. And one day, the boss, who had been a friend of my sister's, that's how I got the job, asked me if I would drive a truck full of Pepsi-Cola to a town maybe about 50 miles away to another distributor and drop off, take it up, and they'd unload the truck. Well, when I get there, here I am, a young kid, knowing nothing about anything. I did have a license to drive a truck by then. Arrive at this
good
place.
Training.
Yeah.
I mean, on a throughway.
Right, on a throughway. I got to this place to deliver this Pepsi-Cola, and there's a picket line. And people with picket signs, and they wouldn't let me through. They were striking against the
Pepsi?
Owner of, I don't know if it's Pepsi, but the owner of this distributor. He's probably a private distributor.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know what to do. I was scared. I was really scared because these guys were mean. I mean, you know, if I tried to run through their picket line, who knows what they would have done.
That's serious business.
Of course it was.
Yeah.
So I didn't know what to do. So I turned around, I drove down the street, and I called back to the home base and told the boss. I said, they won't let me through there. I don't know what to do. He said, well, I'll call another friend and we'll have you drop it off at some other place. And I've forgotten. But it was the first time that I had ever had an experience where I personally was involved in a labor dispute where I felt frightened.
Really?
I can remember that feeling to this day that, you know, they could throw a bomb at me or shot me or something. So anyway, that was that.
There wasn't much industry in New Rochelle, as I recall.
Well, this is in Albany.
But I mean in New Rochelle, so you weren't around much of that. There were no factories or...
No, there was a 7-Up bottling plant. The Joyce family had a 7-Up bottling plant. There was a... You know, I think you're probably right. I don't recall much industry at all.
Even during the war when I had lived in Connecticut, we had to move there so my father could go into defense work to stay out of the military. So we had to move to Connecticut where they converted the old watchmaking factories into ball bearing plants.
Well, they had plants in Bridgeport and some of those places. But no, in New Rochelle, I don't recall. It was
that was more a bedroom community.
Bedroom suburban, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, this was outside of Albany, New York that summer. Anyway, I survived that, but I was remembering that the other day, and I was thinking about it, watching something on the TV news about some picket of some strike someplace. I've already told the story of pharmacology, which almost got me thrown out of medical school. Oh, Celia reminded me the other day when I was saying to you that I never went into surgery. I really wasn't that interested in surgery, to be very honest with you. But I hated getting up early in the morning and going in and having to make rounds and then show up in the operating room at 7 o'clock in the morning. And she said, well, did you tell Eileen the story of when you were in surgery and... something fell on the floor, and the surgeon asked you to pick it up. I wasn't scrubbed in, so it wasn't a matter of breaking a sterile field, but I bent over and my green pants split. And he said, "You're never going to be a surgeon, kid. Get out of here." So I walked out. I must have been embarrassed with my underwear hanging out. Walked out, and I don't know.
What was that about pharmacology? What story was that?
Well,
did you tell me?
Yes, I told you that at the end of my second year, we had to take national boards and pass them in order to go on to the third year.
Mm-hmm.
But I had been very ill before. In the spring of my sophomore year, as a matter of fact, just before I got married to Celia, I had infectious mono. I had not studied for a number of weeks. I was exhausted. I had been living at the downtown Wellington Hotel, taking mm-hmm. care of this man. And I went in and took the exam, and I flunked it. And so the professor of pharmacology brought me in. I think there were maybe two others who flunked it, too. Forgotten exactly how many.
Oh, that's for the pharmacology.
And he said, we'll let you study for a couple of weeks and come back and we'll give you an oral exam. And if you do okay in that and you pass the national boards, we'll give you a passing grade and let you go on. Well, it turned out I did okay with their oral exam, but I did very well with pharmacology, primarily because I studied very hard with Steve Sullivan, my roommate. I had left the man at the hotel and gotten a rooming boarding room. Anyway, that's what that was about.
But then you gave up that job.
I gave it up that
job.
Yeah, I only did that. I did that for most of my second year.
Mm-hmm.
I did it for probably about 7 or 8 months into the spring of my sophomore year. I only put down under mentors, I put Dr. Voorhees, who mm-hmm. was the chief resident in pediatrics when I was a junior in medical school, and it was she who really piqued my interest in pediatrics, and I credit her with having an influence. And when I graduated, I may have told you this, when I graduated in 1958, I was given the pediatric prize as the outstanding student in pediatrics. So I really, under Mary Voorhees' tutelage, really, when I was on pediatrics, I worked very hard and I did very well. And
she was MD.
She was a physician. She was a pediatric resident. She was only a couple of years ahead of me. She ultimately went on and became a professor of pediatrics at Syracuse University, but at that time she was a resident.
That's an unusual name. There's a place right outside of Albany called
Voorheesville. And no relationship.
Oh, no.
No. But you're right, it's Voorheesville.
I had never heard of that before. A friend of mine lived in Voorheesville.
Yeah, it was right near Albany. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I don't think she was related, but Mary was a wonderful, and the other person who had a great influence on me was Dr. Maynard Guest. Maynard Guest. He was an internist in town. He was not full-time on the faculty, but he used to take students into his office, and he was the first physician who I observed taking care of patients in an office setting, and he was very influential in me. We talked about my joining the junior and senior medical student program and getting a salary and having some money finally, and Celia and I getting married,
and you had your first child.
Yeah, we had Peter. Peter was born when we were seniors in medical school.
And what is this here, ETOF?
That's ETOH is an abbreviation for alcohol. There used to be a couple of professors who enjoyed taking students to a local bar, and I only put that in because I think today it would be frowned upon of a professor taking students out and buying them beers after a day. Maybe not. Maybe it's still done. I don't know.
Did it at the medical school.
Yeah, maybe you're right. Anyway, I didn't.
I know a few who used to take the students out. They looked forward to it.
Yeah. Then I went to the next shows is in El Paso, where I'm doing my internship.
Uh-huh.
And there I wrote down Dr. Claude Ballinger's name because he was one of the pediatricians at Beaumont Army Hospital in El Paso,
mm-hmm.
and wrote me several letters of recommendation when actually he wanted me to go to his alma mater, which was Washington University in St. Louis. I ended up going to Penn, as you know, the University of Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. But Claude was a wonderful pediatrician and was another one of my role models. So what I've done here is written down a number of people who in my life, I think, in retrospect, were influential mm-hmm. in my life. Over on the right-hand side, I've already told you the story about that's Lieutenant General's son.
Yes, son.
I won't repeat that.
Yeah.
But it was the first and only place I ever saw a rattlesnake bite. A little kid was brought in one night.
This is El Paso.
Yeah, this is all in El Paso. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all these right. lines. Yeah. It came in with a rattlesnake bite, and I knew nothing about it. Fortunately, one of the residents in medicine had taken care of a rattlesnake bite, and we were able to get quickly rattlesnake antivenom. And I remember sitting up with that kid at night. And in those days, you injected the site and around the site and then the arm, and you kept it in ice. And
had anyone done anything first, preliminary, to bring him in?
I think the father...
The old thing of cutting
it
and all that.
I think that was done. Of course, I'm not even sure that's a proper thing to do anymore.
It supposedly is not.
Not. But it was the only time I saw a rattlesnake bite. The kid survived, but boy, that arm must have been...
Really?
His little arm must have been the size of my thigh by the time
it
got swollen.
How old was this?
He was, as I recall, he was a boy maybe about 8 or 9. Mm. And been out in the woods, and of course there were rattlesnakes. It was the only place I ever saw coccidioidomycosis meningitis. It was a little child who had coccymeningitis, and I remember very well in pediatrics having to give this kid IVs of a very potent drug that they used in those days. I'm not even sure. And he'd get a fever and all that. The other interesting...
Did he survive, do you recall?
By the time I left after a year, he was still alive, but he probably
ultimately
had severe damage to his brain, although I don't know that. Mm-hmm. The one interesting and most bizarre, or not bizarre, but the most interesting and rare disease I saw during my internship was acute intermittent porphyria. And I don't think I've spelled it correctly.
No, that's all right.
I'll look it up. Acute intermittent porphyria, which is a very rare disease, mm-hmm. genetic, in which people have all sorts of neurologic problems. But interestingly enough, they put out, when they're in an acute crisis, they put out a byproduct of porphyrin metabolism, which comes out into their urine, and on standing turns sort of dark red, like a red wine. Mm. And this woman, when the nurse put in the catheter and we took out the urine because she was in coma, one of the things in those days, I mean, one of the things you get with porphyria is you can go into coma, and this lady was in coma. I was the intern on the service. The nurse put in the catheter, and I called the resident, and we were doing whatever you did in those days for people in coma. And lo and behold, she said, look at this urine over here.
Yeah.
And the urine was this dark red. Well, the resident, and I was an intern, we didn't know what it was. So... He said, you go to the library and start looking up the causes of red urine, and I'll take care of the patient, and he did. And so I can recall sitting up most of the night with him in the lab doing various tests with a lab technician and reading in the book, and in one of the reasons for this, of course, that fit this woman's clinical picture was acute intermittent porphyria. So what was... Typically what happened at about 7:30 or 8 in the morning, they still do it to this day, the chief of the service, or in this case the head of medicine, comes and has morning report. And so the residents and interns would report to him and to the other staff, the room would be filled with people, about who was admitted the night before. And so the resident said, well, Tom, you present to Colonel... what was his name? I'll think of it in a minute. Colonel Hunter. That was his name. Colonel Hunter. It just came to me. He was the chief of medicine. You present the patient, and the way he would do it is the way typically in Socratic teaching, you know, you sort of play a game. You give the history and the physical, and then people in the audience are asked questions, you know. Mm-hmm. And I knew what the answer was, and no one in the audience knew what it was, but of course, I only knew because...
Oh, by then knew it was the medication?
Yes, yeah, because we had been working on it all night long.
All night.
And never got to sleep. So I presented it, and it was the first case that many of the people there, including myself, had ever seen, although we'd always read about it. So then it was due to a sulfa medication that the patient had been given at a small base dispensary nearby. It was a woman, actually. I think she was a dependent, if she wasn't a service person. Anyway, it made all sorts of points, I guess, with the chairman of medicine and other staff, and so they asked me and the resident, would we put on a seminar on this condition the following week at the usual grand round. So I can recall that very well. I worked very hard, and I can it was one of the first times in my career where I was asked to prepare a presentation before other physicians, not students, this wasn't medical school, and get up and make slides and all that sort of stuff. So it probably was one of the first experiences I had that said, you know, I might want to be a teacher someday. Yeah, it was. Yeah. I remember it as a very positive experience.
Did you have CPCs when you were in medical
school? Yes. Oh, sure.
So this would have been almost the same.
Similar to that.
Except
this patient didn't die, but the same format.
The same format.
You'd present the patient and all the history and physical and the laboratory stuff, and people would sort of guess what are the possibilities, and then someone would get up and give the answer. Of course, most CPCs you'd have an autopsy report.
Sure.
So I left.
Did that patient survive, by the way?
Yes. Oh, yes, she did. Yes, she did.
Mm-hmm. What was the usual result of that disease?
The disease.
Complete remission? Or?
Yes, you went into remission, and as I recall, until you were confronted with a drug or some other toxin that precipitated the episode, you were fine. So it was one of these things where certain drugs would trigger this biochemical reaction, which led ultimately to red urine and tachoma and that sort of stuff. I'd have to go back and read about it.
Yeah.
And our second son, Chris, was born there. And those are some of the stories I can remember about internships. So now we go to Philadelphia, and we're there for 2 years. And the two people there who were most influential was Dr. Barnes, who was my professor and chairman of the Department of Pediatrics.
Do you remember the first name?
Lewis.
Lewis.
Yeah, he's still alive. He's retired, lives in Florida. And Dr. William Melman, Bill Melman was one of the young pediatric faculty at Penn, and he was very influential. He subsequently died rather early in life. I believe he had some form of lymphoma or leukemia. Anyway, those were two people who were very influential, and there were others. David Kornfeld was influential, but I just wanted to put those in.
I wanted to ask you about the spelling of your son's name. Is it Gary, G-E-A, or Gary?
No, G-E-A-R-Y, Gary.
Oh, I haven't seen it spelled that way.
That's
so
correct. And that's a that's
I thought that was a misprint.
No, just like Gary Boulevard in San Francisco.
Yeah, in San Francisco.
And he's named actually after the husband of Celia's best friend.
Oh.
And we always like that name. And I think it's it may be an Irish or a Gaelic spelling, but it's not Gary, it's Geary.
Okay.
Anyway, Chris was born up. Then we go to Philadelphia, where Gary is born, and you saw. And I told you the story of getting assigned to Spain by going down to Washington. Remember, I told you that whole story.
Right.
Going out to lunch.
And the sergeant or whatever he was who helped with that.
But what the other thing I put there was this was the first time a patient for whom I was caring died, and it was the first.
A child?
Oh yes, I was a pediatric resident.
You only took care of children.
I'm only doing pediatrics.
Okay.
All right, I'm a pediatric resident, University of Pennsylvania, and I'm on call, and I go into the emergency room. And this little black child, I've forgotten how old, probably preschooler, came in with asthma, and I treated her the way we were taught to treat her, sent her home. She came back in an hour or two later, her mother brought her in, and she was still having a bad attack, and I treated her again. And I've subsequently learned I probably should have put her in the hospital when she came back the second time. And unfortunately, I sent her home with some medication, and I remember it was the worst day of my life. Still to this day, I'd say it was the worst day of my professional life. It was a Sunday morning. I was on Saturday night. I was off duty Sunday morning at 8 o'clock. Frank Oski came on. Frank subsequently went on to become one of the premier pediatricians in the country. He just died recently, but he was professor of pediatrics at Syracuse and then became professor and chairman of the Department of Pediatrics at Johns Hopkins for a number of years. was editor of the Pediatric Yearbook and one of the premier pediatricians. Well, he and I were residents together, and of course he was far superior to me and as far as I'm concerned, but he was an outstanding person. At any rate, he came on duty at 8 o'clock and relieved me, and I went home, and I was home having breakfast. I'm going to actually probably take a nap, you know, as you often did when you're up all night. And he called, and Celia said, Frank's on the phone. And he told me that this little child came in and had died in the emergency room. Well, as you can realize, the guilt I had was enormous, and I can to this day still say to myself, you know, is there something I should have done that I didn't do? Well, I guess in retrospect, I should have put the child in the hospital where we would have observed her more carefully.
And, well, you would have had that would have gone to a committee for review.
It did, and the chairman, Dr. Barnes, reviewed the whole thing, and I was never charged or accused of anything. Maybe poor judgment, I should have maybe put the child in the hospital.
What would you have done if she was in the hospital?
Well, I don't know, but we might have put her on oxygen, we might have tried other medications, I'm not sure what we would have done. But
you were guilty about it.
Oh gosh, yes, for a long time, and that's why I put it down. That was the first child that I'd seen death before, but I wasn't the responsible physician, or I wasn't a treating physician.
Yeah.
And I don't know, maybe I'd have to talk to other, but I have talked to other physicians, and I would think that most young doctors or most physicians can remember the first patient that
died. Yes, I would think so.
It has an impact on you.
Did that have such an impact, do you think, that you didn't like private practice?
No, I don't think it had anything to do with private practice. No, because I took care of lots of sick kids after
that. Right, but...
No, I don't think that was it. It certainly made me a lot more cautious.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I was, for the rest of my career in the military and private practice, and even later, I always... and I taught students, I don't know, you'd have to talk to them. I always said, you know, when you're pretty sure you know what's going on, step back and question yourself.
Are you
really sure? Start over again.
Mm-hmm.
And Lou Barnes, this is not, I'm sure, not a quote specific to him, but Lou used to say to us, when everything else fails, because we were being raised now in the beginning of technology medicine, lots of lab tests, x-rays, all sorts of stuff. And so Lou, who was a master clinician, still is, wonderful physician, he used to say, when everything else fails, go back and examine the patient. And I'm sure I've said that to many, many other people, and it's probably a cliche and boring to some people, but a lot of truth to it.
Yes.
You know, when things aren't going right, you have to stop. You have to go back and look at the patient again. You have
start
to say,
over.
It looks like A and B. Could it be C and D? What else is going on? And good physicians do that. But anyway, I guess most physicians can probably tell similar stories of the first patient that died.
Oh, I'm sure it's got to be the most traumatic.
Yeah, you don't forget
experiences.
So anyway, then I finished my residency, and we've talked about how I got assigned to Spain, which was one of the great, Celia and I think, one of the great things that ever happened to us.
Good point in your life,
oh,
wasn't
absolutely.
It?
We went to Spain, as you can see, with Peter, Chris, and Gary, and when we're there, Marty is born. Ted Jacobs in Las Vegas and his wife, so I have the doctors, both of them doctors Jacobs, Ted and Parvin Jacobs, were really my mentors there, and my best friend, of course, was Dr. Lucas Rubio, who was a... Ted and Parvin Jacobs.
Parvin is the wife.
Yeah, Modaber. Parvin Modaber Jacobs. Mm-hmm. They and Dr. Rubio, and there were others, Harry Knudsen, and the whole so-called Spanish mafia that ended up in Las Vegas, and I've told you about them before. There were 7 or 8 of them. All were very important to me because I was still a young physician right out of my residency, didn't have very much experience, and they were all very wonderful to me. But there were a lot of interesting things that occurred in Spain, and some of them I've written down here, and some we've already talked about.
That's when you got your board certification.
Got my board certification.
And
it's also when I gave up smoking. I told you that story.
Yes, I remember on the airplane. And then you got the Air Force Commendation Medal?
Yeah, for my tour, my 3 years there. And but then there were a number.
You're still a captain at this point.
Yeah, still a captain. I didn't get promoted till I got to San Antonio. And I told you the story of the physician who had been addicted to codeine cough syrup.
Oh, yes. Yes.
And I also told you a story about our Spanish professor who ultimately married my older sister.
Yes. And that was your sister?
My oldest sister here.
What was her name?
Evangel. Not my oldest, my older.
Older.
The one who gave me the
your
kidney.
Kidney.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And she had come, she was a school teacher, and she came to Spain and met our Spanish teacher. He used to come to our house, and we learned Spanish from him.
Had she been married?
No. And, but the story here I was going to tell you was, did I tell you about Marty being born at home? The Cuban crisis was on? Cuban Missile Crisis was on?
I think so, but go ahead.
Well, just briefly, Celia was going to deliver Marty, mm-hmm. and it was in the October, November of 62, and the Cuban Missile Crisis was on, and President, of course, was Kennedy. It was before he was killed, mm-hmm. and they told us that all of our dependents had to be ready to be evacuated in the event of a nuclear war. Well, we all thought that was the silliest thing going, and Celia said, what are you talking about? Where are we going to go? We're going to walk out of...